Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our final board meeting of the year, believe it or not. So let us begin with the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all someday. All right. May we have the roll call, please?
Good evening, Commissioners. I'll take the roll call. Chair Hartwig.
Present.
Vice Chair Hurd.
Present.
Commissioner Castillo.
Present.
Commissioner Griggs Murphy.
Present.
Commissioner Montgomery is excused.
Excused.
Commissioner Pitts, also excused.
Commissioner Pitts has sadly had to resign.
Thank you. And Commissioner Jung Lee, excused.
Excused.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have an approval of last month's minutes? A motion.
I will motion to approve, sir.
Good.
I can second.
We have a second. All those in favor? Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? All right, carries unanimously. Go ahead.
Yeah, I did have a question.
Oh, you did?
Minutes.
On the minutes?
Yeah, I wanted to ask the director. The item number E, Ramiro Montaña, did we address his concern there? I just made a note on that.
Yeah, we would not address it publicly.
Right, but
yeah,
did we?
I think that she's received, she's talked to both staff
okay.
in the both departments.
Oh, they did? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great, thank you.
Okay, so it has it is carried unanimously. Minutes are approved. Older unfinished business, we have none.
There is none.
Modifications to the agenda, are there any? No modifications to the agenda have been suggested, so we're going to move on to new business, item A.
Good evening, Commissioners. Item A is a discussion item, and I'm going to walk through some slides. The slides are actually just reformatted points in the memo you received, but I didn't get this done in time for the packet, so my apologies for that. I got it done over the weekend. So we're going to just walk through some of the current status and issues that we're facing in the leasing. A lot of you know about our fair market rent issue and the support we've gotten. There were a couple letters in the back of the packet. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And then at the end, maybe some ideas and some issues and concerns that you guys might have to help us as we try and take on and tackle the issue of improving our lease up using some different strategies. And so I'm going to start, see if this works. And it does not. Is there an on? Oh, hold on. It does. Thank you. My favorite thing was this little pointer, which I cannot point because the screen's not up. So let me walk through some of the memo, high points from the memo first, just for the folks in the audience who, so to bring everyone up to speed. Most recently, Oakland has been, last year and then again this year, one of the highest rent increases. They call it an annualized rent increase that they track, and last year we were number two at about 12%, and this year some folks have it as high as 23% over the course of a year of our rent increases. We have suffered in Oakland, I think, more than even our surrounding neighborhoods in terms or surrounding communities in terms of rent increases, and that's primarily because we had farther to go. We were the more affordable area of the region, and so our rents were lower, but they are now quickly catching up to the neighborhoods around us. It's been identified by a lot of folks, including Zumper, as one of the fastest growing rental markets. In 2008, Section 8 families, when they were looking for, this is during the crash, 2008-09, when they were looking for an apartment, we provide listings through the Go Section 8 system. Those rental listings usually had about 20 to 30 choices for each bedroom size. So if a family had a three-bedroom voucher, two-bedroom voucher, they could go look at 20 or 30 apartments and find one. And these are landlords we know wanted to accept the Section 8. They chose to list with us and advertise with us, and it was a good resource. By October of last year, the Go Section 8 started getting a decline, and they had about five per bedroom size. So if you come pick up the list now, you're labeled to get anywhere from 1, 2, 3, 4, to under 10, in each bedroom size of landlords who want to list. There still are landlords who want to list, but it's nothing like it used to be. The whole process of rent increases for Oakland and what we're experiencing is really a regional problem. This past summer, we convened a rent tsunami summit, is what we called it. Representatives from 11 Bay Area housing authorities all the way around the Bay, all convened in this very room, actually, along with HUD officials, just to talk about the leasing challenges and issues that all the jurisdictions are facing. Some of the outcomes of that are in this table. And if you look, I've bolded the lease-up percentage. And then in sort of an orange color, we have where OHA sits compared to the others who attended. And this was in July. We were at 94. We've dropped about a point and a half to 2 points now, 6 months later. Not good, considering we're trying to do the exact opposite. We would like to be up to 100%, maybe a little bit over, 101 or 2. We've got a lot of voucher searching. But if you look around the Bay, you'll see that other people are in worse shape. Some I hear are down into the 70s now. So this was about 6 months ago, and we were underleased by about 817 vouchers. If you look at San Francisco, they have 1,479 vouchers that are being unused. Richmond, 167. City of Alameda, 184, much smaller programs. And Santa Clara is 1,967. And again, that was 6 months ago, and we did not update this table, mm-hmm. But I would venture to say they're in worse shape. For OHA, our current status is that we have 609 vouchers that have been issued since March of 2015, and only 18.9% had secure housing by the end of October. So roughly just under 20% were being successful, or one out of every five families who get a voucher are able to use it. Still higher than our neighbors, I would add, but I would also say the worst that we've ever experienced in Oakland. We've never had this hard of a time leasing, nor have we had this low of a lease-up rate when we've tried to lease up. The other thing that people have is how long it takes a voucher holder of the 18% to find a place. How many months does it take? And that has been grew from a shorter amount where it could take 60 days, and it's gone on now. We now have extensions approved up to 180 days, and we'll go longer than that based on reasonable accommodations. At the end of that period, though, you lose your voucher, and then it gets issued to someone else, and it becomes this circle of fools who are trying, you know, on OHA's part, because we're taking a voucher that couldn't be used because of the market, saying, okay, you're done looking, and we're giving it to someone else and saying, now you go look. Not a real effective way, I don't think, to manage a program. Those rules are all within the Code of Federal Regulations and how we go about doing it, and it's not necessarily the best approach in this kind of a market.
Now, Eric, can mm-hmm. I ask yeah. a question? I mean, if we want to, we say, well, you've timed out on your voucher, so we have to give it to someone else. Can we give it back to them?
Give it back
can,
to the...
Can we reissue the voucher to them, or do we have to give it to a different person?
No, they're withdrawn. Unfortunately, under
really?
The regulations, yes.
Under federal regulations?
Yeah, they have to be withdrawn, and then they have to apply to get back on the wait list. And I'd like the record to reflect that Lynette Jung Lee has joined the meeting. Thank you. I think looking around some solutions with that, you don't want people looking forever. You want them to be successful in their search.
Yeah.
You also don't want to have too many vouchers out in the street at one time. So if you have, like we do, maybe 300 vouchers out looking, there aren't 300 apartments out there of folks who are going to mm-hmm. participate. And the question is, how do we end up with so many vouchers on the street? It wasn't us issuing. We issued a lot of vouchers, that's true. But we've had a lot of people requesting to port in from our neighboring jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those searching are actually ports from San Francisco, from Marin, from Contra Costa, Alameda City and County. So we've gotten, what happened last year is the tide turned from us porting out families to us having families ported into us. And that changed. And so this year we've got, you know, quite a few families that are from other jurisdictions that are in Oakland looking for housing. They compete against the Oakland vouchers who are looking for the same housing. You don't want too many vouchers on the street. And I think we do have still a little too many vouchers on the street. And we've been very tolerant and aggressive about extending those vouchers as long as we're regulatorily allowed to extend them, and under a reasonable accommodation that can be really whatever is needed for the accommodation. It's not regulated that way. So in September 2015, as you know, HUD published fair market rents for the East Bay. The East Bay metropolitan area is Oakland-Fremont, so that's ours. It's not connected to San Francisco, Santa Clara, or the North Bay, but it's just Contra Costa County and Alameda County. They call it Oakland-Fremont metropolitan area, and it lowered the rents. So they said suddenly our rents were going down when, in fact, our families were experiencing great hardship because landlords were raising rents, and some were having to pay more portion of their, a higher portion of rent than they currently do. So that when they published the 2015 fair market rents, they published them first for comment, and then they released their final. So during the comment period, we were greatly aided by the mayor, Council President Lynette Gibson McElhaney, who was heroic at putting a mic to all this, and the mayor for the background in terms of following up with HUD, and most notably, and I mean seriously most notably, Barbara Lee, who's one of the most effective folks on the Hill that I've ever had the privilege of working with. So she was able to get a significant amount of attention, which included me on the phone with the secretary talking about this issue for the East Bay. And I think that is a huge accomplishment, and it speaks highly of our congresswoman in many ways. The result of that is that I knew HUD wanted to do something. They understood the area. What they did is approve us to go up to 125% of the fair market rent. And what that means is they establish a fair market rent, and that's the 100%. We can go 25% above it. The condition, though, that I'm not happy about, though thrilled about the work of our electeds, is they only gave us that as a stopgap measure through March of 2016. And by the way, we just got the letter Friday, so it's not in your memo. And so I changed this. That's why I was saying we didn't get it in the packet, and we just got the approval letter. So it's only temporary through March, and there's no additional money to pay for it. So that creates a couple of problems, but I want to walk through the fair market rent issue so you can get an idea of why this is important. Look, in the top of this table, the table that's in the memo and that's on your screen, you have the 2015 100% fair market rents. And I'm going to focus on the one bedrooms. I highlighted in the memo the two bedroom, but then I want the statistic I'm going to show you next is one bedroom, so I wanted to compare apple to apples. The proposed 2016 fair market rent for a one bedroom went, in 2015 it was $1,260. HUD's initial proposal was to drop that to $1,235. So it had been lowered a little bit, not gigantic, but still a little bit, for a one bedroom. If you go to 125 payment standard of that 1,235, it's at the very bottom of the table in the bolded section, and it's $1,543.75. So what HUD has said for the one bedroom is we can go up to $1,543.75. That was under the proposed. They issued on Friday not only the approval, which told us we can go to 125, but they also issued the final fair market rents after the comment period. They did change the way they calculated it, which was based almost exclusively on our interventions with elected in this area, and I don't want to stress that amount. Had we not exerted the kind of influence and political voice that our electeds gave us for this, we wouldn't have gotten that adjustment. So that did go up a little bit. They're changing the way they calculate it, which is ultimately what we want them to do. They promised in the letter they're going to make further changes, but this year they did make some adjustments, which actually changed the final one to $1,249. Not a big enough change, and I'll show you why. So even if we're going to be able to rent an apartment, a one-bedroom apartment, at 125% of the FMR, the most we could rent an apartment for would be $1,543. So let's look at what came out last week in terms of the rents around the Bay Area. Here's Oakland, and this is the source is Zumper, and this was actually in the Business Journal. So these are the costs of one-bedroom apartments around Oakland. It leaves you Elmhurst, Fruitvale, and possibly Central Oakland at 1,600, 1,450, 1,500 each. Everything else is basically priced out. And the figures you're looking at that in the Oakland rents chart are all one bedrooms. So it's dramatically reduced our geography in terms of placement of the vouchers. And one of the goals of HUD, of course, is to have inclusion in neighborhoods and use the Section 8 program to make sure that all neighborhoods are represented and have affordability. That's not happening under the current implementation of fair market rents. And I think HUD recognizes that very severely. And we'll be doing something about it. But Washington does not move quickly. And I don't know when they will get out the new method that they will calculate the rents. But they, from what I understand, have several different formulas that they're looking at within HUD. And they're going to come out with something, they hope, this year. They do this every 2 years. So this year we'll have a pass on the rents.
Eric?
Yes.
I'm just curious. This is a pretty substantial error here, I mean, that is being made on the part of HUD, it seems to me, because, I mean, it's pretty easy to find out what the prevailing rents are in Oakland. I mean, do we have any idea what is driving this or what is going on here or what the methodology is?
Yeah,
I mean,
very much. So what they do is they use 2013 rents, and then they use national annualized data to adjust those to the current year. And what we learned is that in the majority of the country, there weren't really any changes in the rent.
That explains the problem right there.
Yeah, exactly. So our Opine letter, which I know it's been several months, which we sent in for comments in September, was really around the flaws in that. And anytime you're going to use national data in a hot rental market with an increasing rent, we're going to lose.
Always.
Always.
100% of the time.
On any issue. And we are number one, first in the country on this issue. We are the ones most penalized by having the rent increase, and we had such a dramatic rent increase over such a short time. When the rent, the formula has worked for a lot of years because there has not been huge rent swings like what we saw. And the reality is that if there's a downward rent swing, we benefit from that here, because it takes so long for the formula to adjust. But who really benefits right now are the people in the jurisdictions that don't have rent increases, because they're getting one because our rental market went up. And it's shared similarly in a couple of other hot rental markets. But we're by far the worst in the country in terms of being damaged on this. So to effect more meaningful increases in the FMR, OHA is participating with other housing authorities as well as a number of nonprofit housing providers, and we're completing a rent study. The rent study is being done based on a procurement at the county. It's being coordinated through Alameda City, and I'm grateful for Vanessa Cooper and her work on this. So if you run into her, be sure and thank her. We are paying the lion's share of that because we're actually proportioning out based on voucher size, and then the nonprofits are kicking in, a lot of them $2,000 each, which really helps bring down the cost. The cost is over $100,000, and so it's not cheap to do this, but it's absolutely essential because it's going to make a huge difference in our annual budgets and mostly in preserving households. And not to be dismissive of the 125%. The 125% is what HUD could do quickly, and they did. And the Secretary made sure that happened really rapidly, and the approvals happened really rapidly on HUD's time clock, because they know what that means is if we have households at risk because the landlord has raised the rent and they go higher than the FMR, or the tenant portion has huge rent increases, we can do exception rents between now and March until we get the new rent survey done. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, for all of us, a really big gain for our families, and I'm grateful for it. So that's the FMR issue in a nutshell, and a couple other areas I'll just talk briefly about. Owner participation and rent increases. The shift in rental markets has an impact on people offering units for rent. And there's really a disincentive in participating in the Section 8 program that has nothing to do with other than the bureaucracy behind it and the inspections. When you have 10 applicants, if one of them is Section 8 and you're going to get the same rent from everybody, why participate in the program? And that's something I think we all have to work at addressing, because it's an ever-growing concern. other people who are currently on the program, the owners feel like they can raise rents more than our policy is allowing. So you've had a couple landlords this year come to the board for different concerns or issues really around that. That's the core issue. How can we reasonably raise rents in real time? And when I say raise rents, I'm saying how much the landlord can charge and how much we can put in terms of subsidy, and not necessarily raising any rent on any tenant, because their portion, if we do it correctly, should stay virtually the same. The third bullet is really just talking about the administrative burdens that are required and the rent reasonableness process that's required in order to grant a rent increase, which is cumbersome and challenging for some owners, because we do make you bring us some data and we look at it and make sure it's okay. But our rent increase requests have increased during the course of the year. And in October, we received, and I love this number, 911 requests for rent increase.
That's pretty funny.
And that is an all-time high. I don't believe that the department has ever received so many rent increases in a given month. So we are very busy next door trying to process those, make sure they're reasonable, make sure they're fair, make sure that they're equitable, and hopefully mitigating damages to our participants and also benefiting our landlords so that they can get what is a fair market rent on the unit so that they will continue to participate.
Well, that's actually close to 10% of our entire voucher inventory.
Yes, right? And remember that when they file for this, they have to do a lot of work before. So they, you know, they need to get a couple of comparables for us, and then they submit it, and we review them and verify them. And most of them get granted. And it's in the monthly report every month how many rent increases are submitted, how many are approved. So OHA's increased its payment standards now to a maximum of 110%, and that's what we were allowed to do without HUD approval. Mm-hmm. And now, as of Friday, HUD's approved us to go to 125 through March 16th if needed. Michelle is out, by the way, and so she won't be joining us. Donna Whitmore is here, I think, assistant director, and so is Andreas Manriquez if we get questions down the road. But I just want to let you know that we'll be talking when she gets back next week and after the later this week, really about whether we're going to implement 125, because where I really want to put my money is getting the fair market rents survey done and have them increase that. But if we have real negative impacts on families, then we'll use exception rents and the 125 to preserve the families in place. And that has occurred a couple of times already where we have people who the rent increase will force them either to move or become excessively burdensome in terms of the amount of rent. So we'll be looking at that until HUD can do it. But the rent survey should be completed on Friday. We're committed to get it to HUD very, very quickly, get it reviewed and committed to HUD early next week. And then we have already been talking to Congresswoman Barbara Lee's office to make sure it is expedited, as well as to the Assistant Secretary of Public at Indian Housing to move it through. Although it goes to it doesn't go to that department, it goes to another one, PDNR, and they're aware of it too. And I was able to talk with the head of PDNR, the Assistant Secretary head of PDNR when I was in Boston, because she was at that conference. Very smart, wonderful person, I think. Catherine O'Regan's her name, and make sure she knew that it was coming and when it was coming, and that we really wanted to turn it around quickly because the 125 is just not a good solution. So we've greased the wheels to get a quick review of this. We'll know what the numbers are on Friday afternoon. I think that'll improve everything. But I wanted to make you aware it's not going to improve the landlord participation unless we come behind it with some other remedies and that landlord and some incentives. So aside from the 125%, which is the first bullet, some of the other considerations that we have is OHA's, you know, and the rent survey, which will change it, is to provide incentives for property owners. We're considering a couple of proposals under what we're making up to be a landlord excellence program, and it'll be an MTW activity. We're sorting through it now. We have to have our new MTW activities locked down in January, and then they'll come before the board after a public hearing comment in the first week in April. But it's always in March's meeting, but Cesar Chavez is going to push that 1 week. So I want to go through a couple of our proposals, because the whole crux of, I think, the discussion, what we're hoping to get, is just any guidance, advice, and suggestions from the board in terms of how we can improve landlord participation, what we could try and improve on within the department what we could offer, to the world outside. So I want to give you a couple of our thoughts. One is to provide a vacancy loss of up to 2 months. In the project-based program, if a tenant moves out, you get up to 2 months of housing assistance payments to re-rent it. In the old housing certificate program, which was the original Section 8 program that passed in 1974 and ran through the mid-90s, I believe, is when it flipped, from a certificate to a voucher, they made certain changes. One of the changes is they took away the vacancy incentive. And I think in this market, that was a mistake. And what we want to do is create something that if you have a Section 8 tenant and they move out, and you rent to another Section 8 tenant, you can then, when you rent to the new Section 8 tenant, you can come back in and file and get up to 2 months of vacancy loss, just like the old certificate program. I think that incentivizes landlords to continue to work with us. And, we have some landlords that are, most of our landlords are mom-and-pop landlords with small buildings, the unit count under 15, 12, and they really work hard to work with us, and they've been working with us literally for decades, and I think we can hold on to them, but we want to make it easy and decent for them. The other thing that we're considering is a one-time incentive payment. So if you have a new unit, if a landlord gets a Section 8 into a unit they haven't had Section 8, then they can get some sort of incentive payment. We're throwing around amounts. It'll be modest, but it'll be something for the extra challenge of getting into the program, going through the inspection and processing, which takes some time and can be challenging. So if we do maybe a $500 incentive on move-in, we think we might be able to get more landlords to participate. It takes some of the sting off the forms when you're looking at them and the inspections. The other thing we're talking about is making automatic annual increases in rent that go across the board. So you don't have to come to us and apply for a rent increase. If we can look at neighborhoods and figure out some method for doing across the board adjustments, then it would make their life a lot better because they would get rent increases without having to come file with us.
Along those lines, because mm-hmm. that's kind of a cool idea, but how is that affected by the Oakland Rent Control Board and the ordinances?
It's interesting because I had one, units, and chime in when we get to the right point because we've gone round and round just recently. Berkeley has a rent control ordinance that has some references to setting fair market rents. The Oakland ordinance does not. When we are setting fair market rents, the units that are rent controlled are excluded from the calculation. Now, the one exception that I would say is looking at buildings or at units, if it was just leased, even if it's on rent control, then you're setting the fair market. But if you've been there for several years, then you have a stabilized rent and it doesn't reflect the market. So we don't use rent controlled units, and that's what both our admin policy and the CFR and our implementation do. So those get backed out. Now, that's an incentive for an owner that has a rent control apartment where someone's lived there a long time and it's well below market. Because if they will voucher in place, meaning put a voucher where that person is living and say, I'll accept the voucher, they can actually get a higher rent than the rent-controlled unit. In rent-controlled jurisdictions, of which I have managed this program, it is so much easier when there was no vacancy decontrol. You didn't get pushes of tenants to move out. And you got landlords actively advertising for Section 8 tenants to get around the rent control law. Mm-hmm. So, and tenants in place landlords were always very willing to voucher in place because the rents were much lower than market. And as soon as they went to the Section 8 program, it was set on the fair market rents were set and they were higher. And so they always were thrilled to accept the voucher. So your lease-up rate stayed really high. That has changed. Costa-Hawkins, which was passed in 1996, guaranteed vacancy decontrol. And that incentivized landlords to have vacancies every 5 years or so to raise rents in rent-controlled jurisdictions. So they could go to market. They were really started aggressively looking for tenants who looked like they would be there a few years and then move out. And they could reset the rent. In terms of even modified vacancy decontrol. Now, that's where you have, if a tenant vacates, maybe you get a 10% increase, which was a jurisdiction I once worked in. That was the same case. It was so obvious in some cases that landlords were actually screening to who they thought was least likely to rent long-term so that they could get their 10% increases. But what it also meant is Section 8 voucher holders had a very easy time leasing up because you were exempt from all that. You got market rent. and it was much easier to deal with us than it was the local rank board. None of that, some of that is true in Oakland, some not. Tenants are protected here. They have EE protections for just cause, but they don't often know about them. And I think that some of the preservation efforts the city needs to make in terms of preserving affordability for existing families, to make sure tenants have access to information and counseling early on when there's any problem with their tenancy. In terms of our program, it can also benefit landlords when there's long-term tenants who are in rent-stabilized rent units that they that are below market because of our local rent ordinance. But we don't have a hugely strong rent control ordinance here and never have. And we have vacancy decontrol, so we don't have an incentive really to, through the rent control, to do that. And since that's changed, there are other jurisdictions that are facing huge pressures, including Berkeley, that has issues around their rent control, that are really a lot of pressure on the Housing Authority and on the Rent Control Board and on the city and where that goes. But we need to find other solutions here to make sure we make it possible for landlords to participate. And I want to say also that our landlord community in general, I think, really appreciates as a view of having an inclusive city. I don't want to paint them even close to being our enemy. They are the reason we are here in terms of providing so many affordable units to so many of our families. And one of the things I like to say is the number one provider of affordable housing in Oakland is the private market through the Section 8 program. It has more families every single night through that program than all the other affordable housing providers in the city. So we're exploring the other two things I wanted just to throw out, and so you can help make the connections of some of the things that the board's been doing in addressing this issue. One is innovative partnerships to provide housing assistance to currently house special needs families in the city who are receiving some sort of competitively awarded or from the government supportive housing services through the County of Alameda or other programs. And this is the Special Needs Ad Hoc Committee's work, where we're trying to really match housing assistance with a family that's struggling but receiving other assistance. We know they're housed, and we know they're struggling, and I keep thinking if we can just get them some assistance, not only will we serve another family, but we'll help the outcomes in the intent for that population, I think. So that's moving forward, not as fast as I would like, but partially because of some, I get derailed with this in the TW. But that's one of the actions that the board's doing, I think, that could have a huge impact in keeping people in place and stable in their housing. Looking at preserving current Oakland families onto the program and families that are most at risk of losing their housing is, I think, those populations that are being served through other service organizations in the city. The other thing we're doing is we're drafting the release for early January, maybe mid-January, an RFP to award project-based housing assistance to existing units. And this can be for-profit, non-profit. We may do another one for new construction and focus areas, but we've had conversations recently as this past week, and we're going to issue one for existing units, and we don't want to, it got too confusing doing everything, so we're going to probably do a couple. But the first one will be trying to find existing units. Because we've awarded most of our project-based vouchers through the city's NOFA process, and because redevelopment doesn't exist anymore, the original projected figures that we had when the board decided we'd go up to about a little over 30% plus of our project basing have slowed dramatically. The pressure of the requests you get, and if you think back, the number of requests that we get for project-based vouchers has eroded in the past few years because of the funding. So there aren't as many projects being funded by the city, so I don't get as many requests, so you don't get as many requests. So we want to try and get as many of those as we can project-based, because what we know that will do is preserve the resource in the city. And one of the things that in all of the conversations, even with some of the press inquiries we've gotten, is the board's actions when we took the actions to increase the project-based section allocation above the 20% cap, got HUD's approval, and approved those commitments and getting us up, now we're in the low 30s, was actually a hugely insightful action to take at a time when the rental market was not hot, a time when the city had a bunch of vacant units and we had no lease-up problem in Section 8. We took the right action, and that is to project-base as many hard units as you can And I think that that's being kind of lifted up as being really insightful work that the board did to anticipate what is going on now. Now, certainly, I did not see this rental market turn around even close to what it is now. It was more rapid than I've ever seen a rental market increase in 30 years. I've never seen any single market have this level of rent increase in really 18 months. That I expected a much slower increase, but we all expected it to happen. It's just happening quicker than we thought. If we can continue to project-based units, and we're looking at using our MTW authorities to exceed 25% in a property, so if we only ordered them 25%, if we add Section 8 vouchers to that property, then we're locking down those units.
Right.
There are other properties that have no Section 8 on them, but have different kinds of affordable requirements, and we maybe a Section 8 voucher can help improve not only the properties portfolios pro forma in that it will help bring more resources to the property, but also use some of the vouchers to deeply assist some families. The other thing in the RFP that we're talking about is vouchering in place. So if a tenant is eligible in one of the properties, we will voucher that tenant in that unit, and we'll do the project-based Section 8 agreement. If they're not eligible, they would have to wait until the ineligible family leaves, and then they could get a voucher. But we're not going to have any relocation. We're not going to allow any relocation as part of the NOFA, the RFP. We want to make we want to make sure it's very clear and somewhat sold in the RFP that it's for-profit and nonprofit owners. You don't have to be a nonprofit housing provider to administer Section 8, and in fact, most are not. The project-based rental assistance program, which is the work that CAHI does, is primarily done by private market rate owners under contract with HUD. And we think we can maybe lock down some properties in town for private property owners who will participate in the program. They'll get a fair market rent, and we will help preserve the current families and preserve the asset for future families. The other opportunity that we can have some flexibility on is how long is the term. So we can go up to 30 years, so we could do 2 15s or we could do 3 10s. And I think we're going to offer both, because if people say, okay, I don't want to do 15, but I'll do 10, we might get more participation. The other population that I think is really at risk in our households are single-family homes, and we've talked about that at different meetings. We have over 3,000 Section 8 participants living in single-family homes, primarily in the flatlands of East Oakland. And they are renting from corporate investors or limited partnerships who acquired a great number of homes during the Great Recession. My fear is, should any of those investment groups decide to start liquidating their assets and they sell them off individually to people who want to own or occupy them, there's no real protection for the single-family homes in the city and in the city's rent control measure EE ordinance. How we can lock those down is if they are still interested in staying as a rental product rather than trying to hold on, because that was their several initial intent, then maybe we can project base them. We were approached by one of these groups about 3 or 4 years ago when they acquired, I think, about 1,000 homes to see if they could project base them. And I said, well, you know, you need to go to the city. That's how we award, and we don't do vouchers. Now, at that time, our lease up rate was over 102%. So we didn't have vouchers available anyway. But things change. And if they can manage them, Godspeed, effectively, I'm hoping they have. We talked a lot about that, about how you manage single family homes. It's a challenge. But we're hoping to entice them into the program, or at least a percentage of the units that would give the current families protection. There may be a number of that are Section 8 already that would move from a housing choice voucher and then could convert to a project-based voucher, either in place or in the future when they move. But we're really looking for the unassisted families who are eligible and could voucher in place, and that would give them a guarantee of the rent, and they would feel, I think, more secure as a landlord, and the tenants would be protected. So those are our initial kind of walkthroughs about ideas we had. A couple of the service side is the last suggestion, and this is, again, just to get kind of any further suggestions from the board, is how can we improve and better service, particularly our owners who we want to participate in the program. We're launching an owner portal as part of our website that is facilitated through both Yardi and our new website that we did a few years ago. And that allows owners to log into our system and tell where their HAP payments are all correct for all their units and inspection times, forms, tenant information of who we're paying for, where, are all things that landlords can have access to directly through the portal. They don't have to call someone. They don't have to come see us. They can log on and find out. We will continue with some aggressive owner outreach and workshops, and they're being scheduled throughout the year. And Tila Carpenter, our owner services manager, I believe, is here in case we want to talk more. And we're participating with the City of Oakland's Housing Assistance Center, and that's providing some, you know, leasing resources, including referrals for our participants to get security deposits and get some legal referrals if they get into trouble. And in the Mayor's Housing Summit has been meeting, as you know, and I think we have our last meeting on Thursday. But I've been particularly vocal about preservation and about trying to get resources for families and trying to, you know, that area. And so we wanted to put that as an important area. A lot of landlords would be happy to rent with our folks, but they may not have a security deposit, and other people do, so they're going to go with the security deposit. So if having resources, and there are some nonprofits who absolutely will do this, several, have them coordinated in a way that someone who has a unit can go get assistance for that, I think would help the lease up and help our property owners be enticed into the program, because they wouldn't be asking to pay for that over time. They would be part of their application. So that's our ideas in terms of where we are, and certainly we're open for any questions and any ideas and discussion you might want to have.
Questions? Yes, Lynette.
I think I've asked this question before. Under the current system, if a would-be renter finds a unit that they like, that actually might be, are they allowed to put a little more of their own money in order to get the unit?
They can, but there's a limit, and that's where you get into the fair market rent issue. They can't exceed 40% of their income, because then HUD just considers it too punitive and the family has to move. You know, they start out at 30, and some people get significant rent increases because they do have significant income, and so when they redo the rent, and it can be kind of punitive. There's been a couple excessive cases, I know, not in Oakland, but I've seen the letters back and forth from our neighbors.
Do you have a question, Marlene?
I had a couple questions. So I was reading in the monthly report, and what kind of shocked me is in September, for the rent increases, we had 303 requested. Mm-hmm. In November, we had 9/11.
Yeah.
Why so many there?
No, it's just going up every month. It's just how many landlords come forward. And it has been as high as 500 in different months during the year, but 9/11 is the highest figure we've had.
Okay, so my other question, Director, is when we grant the approval, I noticed that we approved 295. What is the approval process? We notify the resident.
You mean for a rent increase?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to have, if I can, Donna, do you want to come on up and Andres and walk us through that? Or Tila, whoever wants to enter the process of a landlord filing for comps for a rent increase.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're going to be joined.
Thank you, Director.
Yep. They can walk you through it. They know it better than me. It's not easy.
Thank you. Thank you.
But it's not impossible at all, as you can tell.
Thank you, Ms. Carpenter. Yes, thank you.
When a landlord requests a rent increase.
Is that microphone on?
Yeah, press the button.
Hello.
Shh. There you go.
Hello.
Good.
Oh, great. Cool.
Good evening. When a landlord requests a rent increase, we do the comparables. Once we finish with our process, we print out what we call a lease amendment, and we mail a copy to the tenant, and we mail a copy to the owner. If the tenant portion is increasing, we ensure that they receive a 30 days notice to the portion of the rent that they will have to pay. Mm.
What if they can't pay?
then they need to move.
Well, yeah, so we have had that, Ms. Commissioner Hurd. We've had owners who cannot afford to pay that amount. That's the tricky part. And one of the reasons the executive director is going after this increase to the FMRs so that they can have more stability. Because if there are comparables that actually support what the owner is requesting, as our executive director said, our agency gives them the rent increase. And a lot of times, if the participant's payment standard is not affording them the ability to be able to stay at 30%, it means that they have to pay that amount. They have come to us and requested and said, you know, I don't really think I can afford this. We have and continue to speak to their owners and create a relationship between them and the owners to see if they can come to a happy medium.
Okay, another question. I'm putting my resident hat on right now, and so if the resident can't pay and they have to move, what do we do to help them?
We do have the Go Section 8 listing. Okay. We do have some resources. As Executive Director pointed out, we are working with the City of Oakland, specifically Pam Hall is there. She's a great resource for us, and we are connecting our clients with that resource as well as 211, Eaton INR, when they're looking for places. And to be quite frank, owners who contact us who still are on the program, if they have vacancies and we can connect a tenant with an owner, we would do that as well.
Okay. And then two more questions. When they have children.
I'm sorry?
When they have children.
When they have children?
Yeah. And let's say they can't afford rent. And let's say they have children and they got to move. So do they end up homeless? Do we help them with temporary housing?
We don't have temporary housing for the Section 8 program. That's a really good question. Mm-hmm. So when a tenant can't pay the rent, the owner would have to go through the process to actually evict the tenant.
Oh, wow.
If the tenant is not able to pay the rent. Most of the tenants are able to pay the portion that they were currently paying. So they do continue to make that payment. If the owner accepts any portion of that, pretty much the owner has got the tenant in-house. We do connect them with Bay Area Legal Aid, East Bay Community Law Center, if they get served with a notice so that they can get some protection. I have not seen a situation yet where someone has become homeless.
Oh, thank you.
But close to, but not homeless.
But let's look at the insanity of what's set up under the current regulation, because you pointed out is that, in effect, if the rent goes up to be punitive and the tenant can't pay it, the landlord then issues a non-payment of rent. They then evict a tenant for non-payment of rent because the rent went up beyond the program. That eviction then makes them ineligible for the program. That's a program violation to be evicted for non-payment of rent. So there's such strange convolutions. Now, we would take that under consideration in the review process. But if you follow the Code of Federal Regulations to the letter, and that occurs, that person is, according to the Code of Federal Regulations, without any hearing, going to lose their voucher for being in non-compliance.
Okay. Okay, and then two more questions. I'm done. So, the denial process.
The denial process for the owner?
Yeah.
Okay.
The denial process for the owner. When we deny the owner, what we do is if an owner requests a rent increase and the comparables don't support the request that they have submitted, we send them a letter letting them know that. And we also send the tenant a letter letting them know, because the owner has to give the tenant a 60-day notice prior to coming and requesting the rent increase from the Oakland Housing Authority. So we notice them both to let them know that it's denied. Most owners, as the executive director pointed out, then will continue to submit more documentation and comparables and information to support their request. If they're subject to receive anything, we do take it into consideration. But that's our denial process. We do send them something. We pull comparables. Currently, we don't have lots of denials if you look at the dashboard information. we're approving close to 95% of the rent increase requests that have come across.
Okay.
So this passed, for give you an idea, in November, we denied nine.
Nine, yeah. Yes. Okay, my last question pertained to staff. When you have so many that are asking for rent increases, what kind of workload does that create for the staff?
A heavy workload.
Okay.
It does, and it's taking time, I think, to get through this month particularly.
Yes, sir. Okay.
And so you may hear that it's taking too long, but they get them to the date of the application, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So they get made, the landlord gets made whole based on the date of the application. It just takes his time to get through so many.
So it's your processing time on that? It's your processing time, 30 days.
So when we receive a rent increase request, the owner has given us the notice, and we are trying to use 30 days to process. That's definitely because of the large amount, 30 days right now, when you have 911 rent increase requests.
Right.
It's a lot. But as you saw before, when we had the 303, we met the deadline.
Okay.
But I would say that this month, if you haven't gotten them yet, you're going to get a series of other project-based requests, not just who you think. There's more by the end of the year. So I think that the all-time high in rent increases will occur between now and the end of the year.
That is correct. Merry I started Christmas. Getting emails today.
Yeah. Those are for project-based Section 8s, however, so they're less risky and you know, in terms of the tenants ever leaving the program or the landlords. But there are a number, including our own OPI, that are going to be requesting increases.
Got some emails today.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Carpenter. Good seeing you.
Thank you. Yeah, you as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Director.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I kept, while you were doing your presentation, I kept trying to come up with something to add to this conversation. I could tell right away how rich the discussion must have been before you put this together and how much thought has already been, you know, concentrated on coming up with solutions in a truly difficult situations. Because as we raise the rents on our folks, there's a whole bunch of people outside of subsidies that also feel this wave of, I really can't afford that anymore. So it's a really difficult situation that we're in right now, and I really respect and appreciate the thought and the time and the commitment that we are going through in order to come up with some out-of-the-box solutions. It seems like you thought of everything. I think that we've already talked about the building a better collaboration with our nonprofits and our for-profit developers. I think, where are the empty units? And they have the empty units, and I think that's going to be one of the ways that we could really get in. So I'm hoping, I mean, I already see that that is happening, so thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I was curious about porting in and porting out. At what point do, let's say, families from San Francisco, do we say, yes, you can come in and look, or have they already found a unit and then we say, yes, you can come in and you, or are they, we're just adding them to the searchers on the streets?
Like so much of the CFR in Section 8 of the CFR, 24 CFR Section 8 is the section we're talking about. Mm-hmm. The portability section is one of the most convoluted, poorly written, difficult, I'm being as kind as I can be, parts of 24 CFR Section 8 that exists. The portability rules are onerous to both agencies, difficult on the participant, but one of the things that they don't allow for us is to say, no, we won't take your port. We have a choice only that we can either bill for the port or we can absorb them into our program. But they can come looking. And they do. And
so are
increasing
they
added numbers. And we
in
can't
the
control
numbers
it.
Of the people that are searching, or is that a group of folks on top of the people that are searching?
No, that's included in our numbers.
So,
they
okay.
have to come to us. We give them an Oakland voucher to go searching with. And just like our families that go to Alameda County then have to go through their second eligibility process to get their voucher and then go searching in Alameda County. I don't like the portability process at all, and I think particularly in complicated jurisdictions where there's multiple housing authorities, that interjurisdictional agreements are in order. And I have been advocating with the county of Alameda, really since 2010, and with their board to try and get an intergovernmental agreement, just to say our vouchers are good in your jurisdiction, yours are good in ours. We don't have to go through this process twice. We're not going to bill. We're not going to absorb. We're just going to let each other use the jurisdiction. This works across several places. The first one that I think ever did it was Anaheim and Santa Ana, which are two remarkably large cities in mm-hmm. Orange County. And they have had a reciprocal agreement for probably 20 years that I know of. It could work, but there was resistance. The county went, I asked the county executive director go to their board in the county's housing authority, and the board turned down the concept.
So as people port in and out, the FMRs change, and so they're moving into a different market.
So if they go into a different market, when our vouchers port in, say our voucher could port into San Francisco because there were available housing, mm-hmm. we would have to pay San Francisco the cost of their voucher.
Yeah.
And Alameda County actually right. has higher rents than we do, higher voucher payments than we would have to pay them. We've always had been, we were at 90 and then 95, then 100, now we're at 110. They've been higher up the scale for a lot of years than us in terms of the percent of the FMR that they've been allowing to meet their lease up, and it costs us more per voucher when they do port. Mm-hmm. The other bad thing is in the administrative fees. It's divided between the housing authorities in a way where if it's porting out, we get a small piece, and then the majority goes to the receiving agency. But it's not enough for them to run a program, and it's not enough for the work that we do to get the first eligibility referral. Yeah. So that's a problem on both sides as well. HUD is going to propose new portability regulations through the rulemaking process. But they say that, and they say, oh, it's going to be out this year, and it could be 3 years. They need to fix it. What we went, if you remember, as our MTW authority, is we said you need to have a reason to port to a neighboring jurisdiction. It's be job, school related. You can't just decide I'm living on 98th. I want to move five blocks into San Leandro. Mm. It's the bureaucratic nightmare those two neighborhoods created.
Right.
The number of people who move back and forth, you know, it really is for no reason other than they move a lot. And, you know, one of the things about Section 8 families that people comment on this is that they are perceived as moving a lot. And that's somewhat true in the past.
Not anymore.
And it's one of those things I think we need to do our education around when people come in and say, do you really know there's less than 1% vacancy in this area? Do you really think this is a time you should be porting and moving or doing anything other than doing everything you can to stay in place and preserve your housing? And that's a conversation that I think we have to have in leased housing to see, make that part of the process. Mm-hmm. You know, make that awareness from the word go when they come in and say, I want to move. Make sure they get counseled correctly that that's highly unlikely that they're going to be successful, that they don't want to give notice to where they are, that they want to hold on to where they are until they find another place. And really think about whether they even want to go through the exercise given the success rate that we have.
Right. So as we've seen an increase in port-ins, have we also seen an increase in port-outs?
No, port-ins. It used to be more port-outs, and now it's all port-ins. And that's because our neighboring areas are even having a harder time. If you go back to where we were in July, and I know it seems old, but it's really not that old. If you think about looking for an apartment for 6 months. But if you look at the lease-up rates that we've got, mm-hmm. you know, and you go across the list, you know, we're, along with Marin, and the highest. Alameda County was at 97. Now, I'm mm-hmm. going to tell you the reason Alameda County is at 97, because they absorbed all our ports.
Yeah. That was good.
So they're staying high. They still have a couple hundred, but that's how they stayed high. So they're an anomaly that you shouldn't count. If you look across the board, what I understand from San Mateo is that they've had virtually no placements to speak of in the past 6 months.
I'm just curious about Santa Clara. Is their waiting list open right now because of the problems that they're having leasing up?
I don't think it is. I also think because of the cost of housing, they are expending their money.
the cost of housing.
The cost per voucher is more than what HUD's giving them, so they're serving fewer people.
And is that happening to us because we're paying more per unit
that
we
will
be?
Yes, because remember the Section 8 program is managed to two figures, one of two figures. The total annual contribution ACC number, which is in your report, 12,800 and some odd, for MTW, or the funds. If you expend all your funds, you're done. Mm-hmm. So it's either one. And for example, in San Francisco, when they say that, you know, I don't think they have on this one, they didn't, but my guess is they probably have a lease-up rate in the low 80s, but that's the majority, if not all, of their funds. But they've run out of money.
Okay. Concerning the rental survey that's going to come out on mm-hmm. Friday.
It's going to be, we'll receive it on Friday.
The graph that you showed showed some rents that are, as far as I'm concerned, fluid now. It could, they could escalate mm-hmm. at any given moment. Will the rental survey include some future perspectives in it that might catch them up to real time?
Well, the point of the survey is to get a real time picture of what rents are now. And that's what the goal is.
Then we submit those to HUD. Under your feet.
They are.
Yeah.
If it continues escalating. Now, I would say that under in an article that's probably a week and a half old, they were estimating that rents in San Francisco had dropped an average of $160 per month of what their listing prices were. Oakland was still having an increase, but San Francisco mm-hmm. wasn't. But that pretty bodes well to the fact that I think we may be at least a more stable environment mm-hmm. this year. There's also indications that with interest rates maybe going up and other
That's
indicators
right.
that we may not have an escalation, that there may be actually some mm-hmm. mild leveling off of our hot economy, particularly in this area. So that could be helpful. But, you know, getting back to the biggest challenge, I put the screen up here, 216 payment standards at 125%. So say you have $1,554 to spend. Mm-hmm. Going to the next map, tell me where you can live.
Right. No, I see that very clearly.
It's just to me as clear and obvious between those two things
as
possible.
I just feel that all of those areas are actually going to start going up like the rest of them, too.
I think there's a chance if the economy stays hot, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You mentioned voucher in place.
Yes.
Where we could put a voucher on top of a family with special needs. For the folks that are currently on our waiting list who do happen to be housed but are paying 80% of their income, mm-hmm. can we voucher in place for those folks?
Yes. Yes, that is our preferred process. When someone receives a voucher, they're living in Oakland,
yeah.
they have an apartment, the landlord will participate, it passes HQS, and next Thursday they start on the program.
Does that happen?
That's our favorite way to lease up.
Yeah.
And we have a preference in Oakland, it's called Live Work. So if you mm-hmm. live or work in Oakland, mm-hmm. you go to the top of the wait list. It's behind veterans, behind seniors and persons with disabilities, but it's there. Mm-hmm. And we're still on that preference on our wait list. So the people who we're serving are actually people who are from the Live Work Oakland preference. Our wait list, as you know, is getting older.
Yes.
And we'll see what we want to do about that maybe at the end of the year, next year, beginning of, you know, of 2017. But being on that preference always has that opportunity.
Good. But do people take advantage of it?
One of the challenges of if you had a tenant and they're living in your unit and they could get a Section 8 voucher, but you want them to move, could you really coerce them to move by saying you're not going to take Section 8 so they will force to use the voucher elsewhere? So, again, it gets back to the relationship with the owners and trying to get them to have a willingness to participate in the program even under that scenario.
I understand. I was trying to see, are there instances where people actually can voucher in place? Do we have a good
record of that? We do have some tenants who come in, and you can tell because their address that they have on their application is actually the address that will become their address on the voucher program. It's not a lot, mm-hmm. but it does happen.
That's really good. I think that's a good opportunity, too. Can a landlord request rent increases? I'm not going to say anytime they want, but there's no is it once a year? It's once a year?
Yes, we tell them that we want them to request it once a year on their anniversary date. Mm-hmm. We have some owners that have been on the program for a while that went a few years without requesting it. So they don't necessarily do it on their anniversary date because they haven't had a rent increase request in over 3 or 4 years. So they meet the criteria 1 year or your anniversary date.
I see. So 911 landlords decided to do it all at, you know, it seems strange if we are only, if they can only do it on their anniversary, then something is really strange. What is happening?
Well, people move in at different times of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Some parts.
So November is one of the times?
So because most people don't move in December. So when you say November, that's the stuff that we have to process for mm-hmm. a specific time. So that's how many came in for processing. So those tenants move, you know, people are mostly stable in September because their children are in school. But historically, that was around the time that they would move to be settled in before Christmas again.
Right.
Or right at the new year. So everybody moves as an ebb and flow. And I think that the dashboard data for rent increases kind of shows that. When you see that,
okay.
you're seeing the ebb and flow of when people actually move.
Excellent.
But also, people don't apply every year. And there were a lot of years nobody applied because okay. we were actually in a rent recession, where the rents went down in the city in 2000, you know, between 2007 and 2009, the rents dropped.
Right.
So nobody was applying for rent increases then. And if they apply for a rent increase now, they come in, they can apply, because they haven't done it in the past mm-hmm. year, for all of their Section 8 units in a property. So if they haven't had, so they'll do them all at once. So suddenly you'll get requests for 5 units in this 12-unit building that may be on Section 8, so you'll have 5 different rent increases to process. So they bring them in as a group because that way it's less work for them in terms of the application and comparables.
Yes, and it could be a property management company that mm-hmm. does that, and it's even more.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you. I just know that that's a huge increase of workload, and I, like Commissioner Vice Chair said, I mean, we just feel for you trying to be in that office right now. I just wanted to provide positive feedback on the suggestions that you have at the end, Director, and to say the incentives for the landlords sound really good. I'm hoping that it works, you know. Had you actually surveyed some of the landlords to ask what they would like as an incentive?
Well, why don't you talk about we have a landlord group that meets. Do you want to just say how they meet and what feedback where you go to them, similar to the RAB, only it's for property owners?
So the landlords, when we meet, even at our workshop, we have a group of people that we meet and we talk about what is it that you would like. The owner portal was really big mm-hmm. for our landlords, as well as a less cumbersome way to request an increase.
Mm-hmm.
The vacancy loss, I think, is in line with what our landlords would look to receive if as a good incentive to keep their property on the program.
So were they... they provided feedback on some of the incentives that we're talking about or the other way around?
So the landlords actually, for the rent increase, that mm-hmm. was specifically a landlord who had a specific conversation.
It sounds like a COLA, right?
Well, I think that the landlord was like, I want a rent increase, but I don't want to have to work so hard to get the rent increase,
exactly.
right?
No,
so we had
good.
Some discussions and the executive director, I called, talked to the executive director one day. I was like, what'd you think? So mm-hmm. definitely the landlords kind of lead the discussion, and they contact the executive office on their mm-hmm. own and have conversations about what they think we could
sure.
do to make the program less burdensome for them.
I was thinking give them a free refrigerator or something like that. I don't know. That sounds good. thank you so much. This is my last question, I promise. Concerning our people getting denied for the apartments that they are continuing attempting to apply for, the 300 some odd folks that are on our streets looking, is it the competition that they are, is competition one of the main reasons that people are being denied? Is it credit reports? Do you know, what are the barriers out there on the streets from your perspective?
Well, from my perspective, definitely credit reports
okay.
and competition.
Okay.
The competition is heavy out there right now in our market in Oakland.
Yes. Thank you for this conversation and this presentation. It's probably just beginning.
Thank you. Indeed. Okay, I have a couple of just real simple questions and then one that's probably pretty simple too. So if a landlord is granted a rent increase And so then they increase the rent, so that would mean that the tenant is paying more, and he's getting more payment from the housing authority or from HUD, right? So both of them go up.
Not in all circumstances. Sometimes the HAP goes up and the tenant stays whole at 30%, or sometimes our HAP stays the same amount and the tenant incurs the full rent increase. And sometimes there is a shared process.
I see. So that would depend on income levels and percentages.
It depends on our payment standards. So the slide that our executive director showed you where our payment standards are, it absolutely depends on where the payment standard is.
Okay, I see. So now what I'm wondering is it, and I hesitate using the word legal, but I mean, supposing a landlord raises the rent, he gets more HAP payment, but there's also an increase to the tenant's rent. But the tenant feels that they just really can't pay it. And the landlord then says, okay, can they do that? So can they take the higher HAP payment is what I'm, the question I'm asking, and tell the tenant that it's okay that they don't pay a higher rent. Is that okay to happen, or is that not?
That would have to be an MTW authority, and it's a wonderful suggestion, so let's look at that. Yeah.
Okay.
Owners do come back to us right now and say, I asked for $2,000. I've talked it over with the tenant, and we agreed that she can't afford that or he can't afford that, mm-hmm. so I want to decrease the amount that I was approved for. We have an owner today who just did that.
Yes, I see. But so, then
but
in
it's
that
not
case,
it's not you choose to take the tenant's money and not the tenant's money and our money. So
yeah,
they
right.
did it, and so we're gonna put the stuff in the system and
okay,
then it'll
cool.
recomputate what it looks like.
Yes, okay, cool. And then the other question just popped up in my mind is like, oh, why are Section 8 tenants known for moving a lot?
It is. It's a perception, and it was something that they.
Is it accurate?
No, not necessarily. Oh. Although when we were talking, and it came, we were in Boston, Michelle and I, at this conference about mobility with Chetty and some Harvard professors, and there were myself and a couple other housing authorities there, and they'd done studies about how often Section 8 participants moved in the initial study, and it was more than I thought. It was like once every 3 years,
wow.
the average, and a couple of the other Section 8 directors that were in the room thought it was every year. And they were saying, oh, and he said, no, it's like 2.5 to 3 years. But that's still moving a lot, you know, and maybe it's just who we are individually and how we think. I don't move. I've realized that I don't move. I'm too lazy. I just stay put, seriously. And other people, though, do apparently, and the mobility issue about them moving, because what they were talking about is doing interventions upon moves to make families more successful and choosing their neighborhoods and schools and things. And he said, no, about two and a half to 3 years is the average that in the study that data he looked at. And that surprised me because it seemed much more frequently than I thought. And so there is a perception, but that's what his average was when he looked at all of the Section 8 program participants, 2.5, 3 years.
I would think that one of the situations to consider is the areas in which our families live in, and that what's going on around them might say, I can't live here. And so there could be some of that going on.
Yeah, so
yeah, that's
it might
true.
Be environmentally induced.
One of my biggest fears about our families is that they're used to being able to move. And that they have, you know, there were times where they were doing what you're saying, trying to find safer neighborhoods, trying to find a neighborhood that they felt safer in. And now they're getting approached to move, and they may be getting offered financial incentive to move from their owners. And they take it because they think, oh, last time it was so easy, and this time it's not going to be so easy. So I think that's part of our education stream with our participants to really we need more counseling, and that comes from the Housing Assistance Center as much as maybe some counseling when they request to move their voucher.
Okay, then my other question is, We know we have a lot of landlords that have opted out of the program, out of the Section 8 program. There's a lot of people that aren't interested in the program. However, there are people that are still in the program because we have groups and we're placing vouchers, okay? Do we know what the compelling reasons are for the people that are in the program to be in the program? I mean, what do people right now in this crazy market, since we have landlords that are saying, yes, I want Section 8, why are they saying yes? Do we know?
There are a couple of main incentives for property owners, and then you can elaborate personal experience. Number one, there's a rent guarantee that they have rent-stable apartments, and even though they might be able to get a higher, a little modestly higher rent off a market rate tenant, they don't want to really go through the struggle it takes often when people get behind in the rents because these rents are so high. So when we are guaranteeing the rent, we actually write the checks and they get regular rent payments, and that makes it better for them to participate. Some of these are in hard to lease areas. Mm-hmm. And so they
we help
to lease. That they, if they accept Section 8, there's a market there for it, and they can rent to someone. And if they're renting to another family, they may not have actually the resources to pay the rent, and they may not meet even the three times, you know, 30% of the income threshold that landlords use to screen. But with our tenants, it doesn't matter. Other landlords have been dealing with us for a lot of years, and they're comfortable with it. They know our process. They're fine with it. They know they can get Tila and her group on the phone when they need help, and they're more than likely, the majority of owners within owner services are very happy, or you would have a line out the door. We do have issues coming up with specific owners, and we've had, as you know, people coming up angry about their rent increase because they thought it wasn't enough and this and that, and that's to be expected when you deal with 7,000 landlords and 13,000 tenants. But I think, remarkably, I think we do a pretty good job, and one of the things we do is the owners' meetings with the owner to kind of run things past them. And we do try and make things as simple as we can, given our regulations. And we are easier than some neighboring housing authorities because HUD has allowed us to be through our process. And the more we can continue to be that, the better we are. But I would say the number one incentive is rent guarantees, and that we are able to help, in challenged markets particularly, help them stabilize their building. Do you want to?
Everything he said.
Okay, so then what that is saying to me then, and this, I'm just testing my understanding now, is that right now, for the most part, it's going to be landlords that are in more challenging areas that are going to be interested in Section 8. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yes. They don't need us anymore.
Yeah.
And that's the simple reality. There are still some neighborhoods that there, I think we have, will have increasing participation. We've had some neighborhoods actually that we had very little participation, and they were distressed neighborhoods. They were dangerous neighborhoods. And if you had a voucher, you didn't need to live there. And those are being now repopulated with voucher holders.
Yes, I see. So what I'm really looking for here is to see if there's any attributes about renting to voucher holders that are important enough that they could somehow be packaged for or communicated with other landlords to try to drive the program. I mean, have we done any? Have we done with the landlords that we work with? Have we done any sort of brainstorming sessions with them where we say, "Hey, look, you know, we got a really cool thing here with these vouchers. There's advantages here. Now, what can you help us think of ways that are going to make people a lot more excited to join the program?" Because I don't know, I mean, some people may say, I don't want to join the program because they're lacking data, for example. They really don't know exactly what it's like. And that may be their reason. So they're making some very negative assumptions about it, which may not be true. Because I'm just trying to, you know, I'm just trying to think of some avenue here in this kind of challenging market here to come up with some good. I mean, I think the ideas that we have here are quite good, but because you know, as I look at this, and I'm thinking, you know, rent guarantees and all of this, and I mean, from my point of view, I would look at that and go, that really doesn't even, I mean, we've had two properties turn over just in the last year. I didn't even lose a day. I mean, it was literally like instant in, instant out. I mean, this was like insanity. I mean, we opened the house up for one day, and it was like floodgates. Oh, I've never seen anything like it. I'm like, oh my God. And so things are just renting like that. I mean, all you got to do is rent something like $100 below market, which is still like a good price, and you got people just
They're renting vans for $500 a month in San Francisco. Yeah, they're renting beds. They're renting couches. They're renting backyards.
It's very serious. Yeah. Well, good. I think this is really some very good thinking here. I mean, I just always think that the best, you know, the best resource is really since we have a lot of landlords that's really effectively utilizing that target market to learn as much as we can, and it sounds like we are doing that. So if you want more help from us or have us try to do something, we certainly will. I mean, we would be happy to form a committee to look at this and see what we can do. And, you know, I can chat with people. I mean, I know a lot of people around town that are in property businesses. So, you know, I mean, we can just like chat with people and kick tires.
I think it might be
see what comes up.
And we'll keep you briefed, and then other things will come before you, including the MTW plan that'll have some of these incentives. And once we get those in place, then doing an outreach campaign to the community, I think, is where we could really use some help as well. And maybe we can have a couple of you attending some of the owner outreach events that we're going to do. We usually do one in May for Affordable Housing Week in this room that's very well attended.
Good.
And if we can get some things in place by then we can get some word out.
Yeah, that would be cool.
And also your Special Needs Commission is working very hard on creating other ways to serve.
Excellent, because that is important.
Yeah.
All right, thank you very much. Oh, now I lost entire track of the agenda. That was so compelling.
We're on B.
But no, I'm back. Okay, so we are going on to item B.
Item B is consideration of six resolutions. They're required by the California Public Retirement System, CalPERS. They're health resolutions, which changes and increases the authority's contribution amount toward active employees and retirees' CalPERS health plan premiums for Local 29 OPEIU, the Alameda County Building and Construction Trades, and for all unrepresented employees. These appear pretty much annually for your review. They take nine votes. The one absent one you'll note is SEIU. Yeah. We went through fact-finding with them. Mm-hmm. We are getting our final offer, I believe, today?
Today.
Went to them today, and then we'll get the fact-finding, and we'll see where we are after the new year. But it's everyone but that, and if we get some resolution to SEIU, then that will definitely come to you separately. And I would say that if we get something early in the year, I may have a special meeting if that helps them to get it in place quickly. But as it stands, these are the ones we're able to move forward with, and we recommend approval.
Okay, so move.
Item has been moved.
I second.
Item has been seconded. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Any abstentions? Carries unanimously.
Thank you, Commissioner.
All right, on to item C.
Item C, approval of a resolution authorizing the executive director to increase the not-to-exceed amount by $25,000 per year on a three-year contract with 2 one-year option terms with Cypress Mandela Training Center for pre-apprentice construction trade services for residents for a new amount not to exceed $125,000 annually for the last 3 years of performance. This is an amendment to the contract that we have. Where are we on the agenda? Okay. This is just an improvement to the contract, and we're actually doing incentive pay for the last 3 years to encourage not only the training of our participants, but actually the retention and full-time employment, something that Janet Rice had worked out with Lanita and the Cypress Mandela Training Center. It was included in this year's budget, and we're just now moving the contract for your approval forward to correspond with those two actions, and we recommend approval.
Do you have a question?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Commissioner Castillo, question.
Can you just tell me why there are six of them? I don't want to guess.
Why there are six what?
Six resolutions. Six,
oh, the
California.
Six, no, that was the last item, and the
oh,
six resolutions are because. Because
and
the,
oh,
to
sorry,
answer
yeah,
that
we
one.
Y'all, quick tonight.
The six resolutions.
We were like lightning on the
yeah.
retirement.
CalPERS requires a resolution for each unit and the representatives, so that's three,
okay.
And they require separate ones for the retirees.
Wow, okay.
So it's six.
Thank you for allowing me to ask that question.
No problem.
So we're on item C.
We're on item
we
C.
We are on item C, yes.
Oh, I'm in agreement with it.
So we're deciding whether we have questions or whether we want to move the item.
Yeah, I'm okay.
You okay? Does that
yeah.
mean you're moving it?
I'll move it.
Okay,
okay.
We have the item has been moved.
I second.
Seconded. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed? Abstentions? Carries.
Thank you, commissioners. And should that need to be increased further because of other additional monies we may receive in the future, it may be back in January.
Okay.
Yes or no. Okay.
Okay. So now we are on to item D.
Item D is revisions to the Housing Authority's travel policy. The Housing Authority Board of Commissioners established a ad hoc committee to review the travel policy in 2015. They've met on December 8th, March 23rd, and July 27th. Revisions to the policy were then created and distributed to the committee. There are a couple of things that I'll just mention, and then we're here for any questions or discussions. The first thing it does overall is it tries to make sure that the policy is more current and in line with other policies, and that certain things don't require changes to the policy, as in the amount of insurance that's required if you drive an automobile. And that isn't just commissioners, but that's really for staff, so that it can be set by the executive director and the risk manager can make the recommendation. And if we want to increase it, then we can increase it. We don't have to come back to the board to revise the policy. So we do that in a couple of different parts of this policy. The other main change was out of the audit for the for our travel program was looking at how we handle bills and account for bills for how we account for meals provided during conferences. The reality is the cost of that is negligible and the administrative cost of that is excessive. And so the travel committee looked at whether or not there was really a cost benefit for that. For example, the majority of breakfasts, they call them maybe an agenda continental breakfast. If you're lucky enough to get a croissant, then Godspeed. It doesn't really constitute a healthy breakfast. The number of meals actually provided, oftentimes the meals are celebratory in nature, and they are usually not necessarily the most healthy or available, and they maybe only occur infrequently during conferences. Secondly, oftentimes commissioners may not attend that event because it's not necessarily, and they could be having lunch with someone else and doing other work around the conference. So it didn't really seem to be of any great benefit. So what we thought we could do is simplify our policy and subsequently simplify finance and the administrative record keeping around it by just saying that we're not going to deduct like so many of our other housing authorities and other agencies don't make that deduction, but our policy requires it. So it brings it more in line with our surrounding policies for travel. Other than that, we did very much defined the Oakland area rather than the Bay Area or San Francisco. We amended the policy to actually define the Oakland area, and we really just took the surrounding four counties to say is our Oakland area for our efforts, and I think that that's an important improvement in reduction. And aside from those changes, it's pretty much the same. We also allowed one paragraph about rental cars. It came up once where it made sense to have a rental car, and I wanted to make sure it was in our policy because it just wasn't in an effective way. So we included that ability. And particularly if, for example, a commissioner were traveling to Los Angeles and couldn't get a flight because something happened up north, it allows you to rent a car and come back up here and turn it in here and that kind of emergency scenarios. And I'm not sure if the members of the Travel Policy Committee want to have any comments, but that concludes our report.
Well, no, just to be clear on what you were saying about the meals. Mm-hmm. So we are avoiding the expenses now associated with the auditing of whether a meal is claimed to be
offered. Yeah, we're not going to make that one way or the other.
Yeah, okay.
We're
going to be silent. That's what I thought we had agreed to. Yeah. Right, okay.
It also, by the way, makes a lot of adjustments that brings air travel back in. It was originally written with the concept that airplane travel was luxurious, provided meals, and didn't make you pay for bags in every square inch. And so what I've done is just recommended for the committee to bring it up to speed to say any baggage fees, any other assessments, any add-ons that are all allowable under our policy. And I think that since that's the trend of the travel agent, the travel business, I think it's important we protect it with a more updated policy.
Just make a couple of comments?
Yes, yes, please.
With Commissioner Montgomery and former Commissioner Maynard, we did look at this issue a lot, and as Director Johnson says, I think it really helps to simplify a number of areas mm-hmm. and make things more flexible, not having to figure out if breakfast is at 20% that just makes sense. And we do know that both commissioners and staff are engaged in many meetings, many side meetings, and sometimes it's helpful to do that at a meal rather than sit in the conference banquet room. So I think the committee was well satisfied with the recommendations, and happy to answer any questions.
Yes.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think I've made these comments before, but I wanted to encourage our new commissioners to attend something that is of interest to you on January in Napa, on January 24th. There's a commissioner's track workshops just dedicated to educating our commissioners, and I just would love to encourage you to come out for that. It really helped me when I first started to attend some of these events across the nation. It just helped me understand where we sit in the national perspective. And it was wonderful to meet other commissioners and talk about housing authority business at the national level. And so I truly encourage our new commissioners to participate. It really helped me a lot.
Cool. Any questions? Motion?
Yeah, I'm ready.
We're good? We're
I'll
good.
Motion.
We're good. All right, we have a motion. Do we have a second?
I second.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a motion, we have a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Any abstentions? Carries.
Thank you, commissioners.
Okay, so now we're on to item E, which is people wishing to address the commission. I have no speaker cards.
There are none.
And there are no speaker cards. So then that means we will be moving on to written communications.
Written communications, I will just walk you through. The monthly report is provided, as we've reviewed in our earlier item, and we're here for any questions. Additionally, I just wanted to walk through the couple letters I included. One is that Congresswoman Lee wrote early on behalf of our fair market rent issue, and I spoke about that in item number one, but I wanted to have a record for our file. On November 6th, we got the letter from Lourdes Castro Ramirez, the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Public and Indian Housing, regarding that, and then our request letter to Jesse Wu at HUD for approval, and we have received that approval, but it didn't make the packet, so I may stick it in next month's packet. For the meeting schedule, there is one thing I wanted to point out, and you have a revised one that we've handed out. The meeting on March 28th is actually Cesar Chavez Day.
Oh.
And we were going through the calendar this afternoon. We're actually proposing to have the special meeting the actual following Monday, which would give us an extra week for our MTW public comment period and plan, which comes at the end. So it'll be April 4th would be the special meeting.
And that's one's a little later, right?
Yeah, it's the week later, so it's the week after, 1 week after the 28th. That may put us in a position where we may not need another meeting in April, and we'll see where we are in April on that. And then you have all of the available travel, and again, there is, right after the first of the year, one up in Nampa that I would encourage everyone to consider attending, and particularly the Commissioner's Day on Sunday, if you're able to do it. Additionally, I do want to mention that the board had expressed interest in more online training if it was available.
Yeah.
There is something available with HUD, and I'm going to get that out to you shortly. They have some online training specifically for commissioners that they have put in place this past fall that I think people can work through some of that. And a lot of you know more than probably the training, but I'm going to go through and board it on. Okay. And I believe that's all of the written communications that I have. So if you have any questions about the report or anything else.
Director, the ethics training that, I took early, does that have to be repeated or is it good? So as long as I took it once,
And it's not really required, but it's great that you took it. The one thing that I would tell everyone is if you have any questions at all about conflict of interest or anything, please consult with Jennifer Bell. She's your general counsel and just a phone call away. And that's the best person to ask those questions to. Any other?
I just wanted to ask under the wait lists for housing choice vouchers and public housing. Am I in the right category here to ask this question now?
It's in the monthly report.
I was just noticing that the number of households on the wait list, which is a different proportion than our total voucher inventory to total public housing, and I just wondered. I was just curious about the numbers.
About
because there's 7,500 and change applicant households on the Housing Choice voucher wait list, and there were 4,200 for public housing.
That's a healthy wait list in public housing.
That's what I thought.
Those are actually all site-based. In public housing, you have multiple wait lists. So they can be site-based wait lists throughout public housing.
So there may be some double counting.
Now, exactly. Okay. They can be on more than one list.
Very good. Okay. And then what was my other question? Oh, the other question I had is I was just looking at the vacancy rates. And I see we have some units in rehab and all that. You know, it just obviously popped into my mind with the crazy housing market in Oakland. You know, why aren't these vacancy rates higher, or is this just, is this really?
No, they need to be, they absolutely need to be higher.
Yeah.
And we've, been working through that, and Andreas Manriquez has joined us, actually is focused on this very much. The units get ready, they need to make sure that families are ready to move in, and so we can hopefully expect to see some dramatic improvements in the portfolio.
So we can do better there.
For public housing particularly, that rate should be above 95%.
Okay, most excellent. Those are all the questions that I had. Thank you.
All right, so moving on to comments. I have a couple of comments to read. First, I want to just let the board know that Craig McBurney, who was our IT director, retired as of last Friday, was his last day.
Oh.
And Terry McCauley is our acting IT director. He's in the back.
Hey,
wave. Thank you, Terry, for being here. More transitions. We have new building, new business system, new IT director. It's going on. There's some other things, and I'll get through them fairly quickly. One is the MTW extension. We are still negotiating very much, and it looks like I'm going to go back to DC either the 8th or the 12th for another meeting. And I will let you know as soon as I know once we get final. This hopefully will be our last in-person meeting, at which point I probably will not be returning to Washington in the foreseeable future, meaning I'm out. You guys are going to have to do it because I'm exhausted with it, to be honest with you. I'll keep you an update in January, and but we do anticipate this is the last one. As you know, we're currently in a budget discussion in D.C., and they're trying to pass something. If they were to pass an appropriations bill, there is language in the bill that would preserve our existing agreement, but we still have to define how they define substantially the same number of families that we have to serve. And that can go – it's very complicated scenarios any way you look at it. If the appropriation bill does not pass and they do a continuing resolution, then we have no protection from the Hill on our agreement. So we'll see how that plans out. I was, as I mentioned earlier in the meeting, able to attend a meeting with Raj Chetty and two other of his study professors at Harvard this past week with Michelle Hassan to talk over how we can develop some innovative programs and study their effectiveness on interventions of family to help improve their health outcomes, their economic outcomes, and their educational outcomes over time. He's done some really innovative work at Harvard. He is moving to Stanford as of this week. He's probably unpacking now. And so after the first of the year, I think we'll get together with he and his group of adjunct student professor people who'd work with him and come up with what we might want to study in Oakland. I'll be out of the office actually the 21st through January 3rd. And the first week, Andres Manriquez will be in charge. The second week, Phil Neville will be in charge. And so thank them for their coverage. And if you need anything, let us know. You might just copy me on anything. I still will be checking some email, but not hopefully as much as I usually do. We are looking at scheduling some media training, and we'll get you some dates, and that will be in February, okay. It looks like. So we'll get you some dates if you want to attend. It'll be on a Saturday, and we'll have some hands-on experience for commissioners in doing it. So we'll get that worked out with Greer. The one thing I wanted to bring up, because we haven't traditionally done it, but I want to recommend that we do it, is there's going to be the Dellums Institute for Social Justice, which is a 501c3 nonprofit, is going to have an event, and we usually don't sponsor it. It is a 501c3 that's doing some important work, and I wanted to consider sponsoring it, and with your concurrence, I'll put it through at a reasonable level, and we will use non-federal funds, just so everyone knows. But it is a nonprofit. They're going to have on Friday, January 28th, at the Impact Hub, whatever that's called, the hub place, they're going to have an event that's going to honor him for 80 years, but it's also a fundraiser to help the Institute, the 501c3. And I just wanted to sort of throw that out today that I'd like to do that, and I'll get an email out to you if you guys concur that, and then if you're able to attend and represent us. I never know if I'm going to make it or not this far in advance. I don't, but if when we get closer, we can figure, and we'll get a sponsorship level to give us a few free tickets.
Is that Margarita?
It's what?
Margarita?
Oh, yeah. Margarita? Yes, Margarita Lynn. It works there along with other folks that you may know that have been around town. So anyway, I will get you an email if you concur. I think it's worth, it'll be interesting to do that, and I like supporting any nonprofit.
Thank you.
Okay. The other one, I want to really thank FCP and OHAPD and all the staff who volunteered this year on the Holiday Splendor.
Yes.
Really, really wonderful job, Linnea and James, just really great. There were a lot of other staff who volunteered that are in the room, and I don't know if, Artesia, I think, left, but who really go above and beyond every year. But I also want to thank we have a resident coordinating committee that works on it, and it's gotten better every year because of the work they do. They make the decisions, they choose the band, they pick the food and the theme, and it really was a blast. The band was out of control good this year, I have to tell you. Really made it a fun night. The Mayor's Toy Drive is this Saturday. FCP will be helping and assisting with that. I believe at Havens Court, at Havens Court School. Additionally, OHAPD and FCP and a bunch of other volunteers from throughout the agency, I hope, are going to be distributing toys. And I think it's 820 kids. Yeah. 816. And we've raised from OHA staff over $8,000 this year from the foundation. And this is foundation money, OHA foundation efforts. Mm-hmm. But it'll be at the service center. I regrettably will not be there, but I will be there in spirit. And it's in the bay of the service center all day Monday. And I'm grateful for all the work, and I'm grateful for the staff for donating so much. I mean, it's a large chunk of money at a time when most people are struggling just to buy toys for their kids. And it was a terrific event. If you'll notice, there's someone in the room, at least I think only one person with a beard. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was part of a fundraising effort. And for the record, the executive director does not necessarily approve of officers with beards anymore. I'm pretty much over. But it was for a good cause, and it's buying a lot of toys. And so thanks to everyone who did that. And I think that concludes all of my notes. That's it. Thank you.
Excellent. So that means we are now moving on to item 9, reports of commission committees.
We met on November the 18th, and we don't have a...
You have...
We met on November the 18th.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't think we scheduled anything for
the
future.
We have not scheduled another one, and there's some notes here if you want.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. All right. So, no reports from committees then. Then, are there any announcements by commissioners? Yes? Go right ahead.
Tomorrow at the Board of Supervisors is approximately 10 o'clock in the morning. We will have housing advocates there to fight for the boomerang funding again for affordable housing. It's so important right now to fight for whatever streams of income that we could bring in for affordable housing. And so your advocates, Donna, and all of us actually are here to try to sit with our housing advocates to push for boomerang funding, to push for Measure A funding, which we got last week. Yes, so there's going to be an increase in senior services and also for families, correct? Mm-hmm. We are also working at the city level to urge the city to pass an impact fee for for-profit developers, and hopefully that will create a stream of income for affordable housing. So I just wanted to let my commissioners know about that.
Thank you.
Of which many already know about that.
If there are no further, now you have an announcement?
Announcement. Just a thank you, though.
Well, you are entitled to give a thank you.
Okay, yeah, just a thank you. It's always a pleasure reading the report, and I want to thank Manita and all the work that you guys do in that department. I commend you with the Section 3 outreach. A lot of that happening there. Thank you. Kudos to you for that. And all the stuff going on with our residents. I'm just really, really pleased to see how we are empowering them into self-sufficiency. So thank you, Ms. Wheeler. One comment. In reading the report under customer service, wow, September we had 7,359 phone calls. Man, how do we process all those? Yikes, that's a lot of phone calls. But I know we're handling them. Just wanted to make a note on that. And the last thing I want to say, I want to thank the, I ended up attending the Building Trades Luncheon. Thank you. Was able to go to that. Did a lot of networking. Met a lot of cool people. And also went to the business luncheon for the Oakland African American Chamber of Commerce. Met a lot of cool people there too. Thank you, Director. And really had a good time at Holiday Splendor. Wouldn't you agree? We had a good time, right? Had a really good time. And wow, we just really, really made that place shine that night. We did a lot of dancing too. But I'm just very honored to serve you all and work with you, and just appreciate all we're doing to help our residents be empowered and get them onto the road of self-sufficiency. So thank you, staff. Thank you, directors. And thank you, those who are in the audience there. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Commissioner Hurt. All right, so it is now time to adjourn to closed session. Do we have a motion to so do?
A motion.
Very excellent.
Second.
Then let us take, how about if we just take a 10-minute break? Does that sound good? All right.
I think we need a motion.